Hi, it's Christian Yordanov. I'm a functional health practitioner and author. My latest book is How to Actually Live Longer, Volume 1. Get yourself a copy if you haven't already. You're going to learn a lot about how to live longer and stave off what I call the three primary drivers of aging and dysfunction, which is stress, psychological and physiological, and inflammation and oxidative stress, which are the archetypal stressors in the body, as I like to call them. So today I'm going to continue the discussion on estrogen. If you didn't watch or listen to the previous episode, please, I would highly recommend start with that one just to get a bit more of the background because some of these things won't make sense here. And if you can go to the website, there is a picture of the pathways in which estrogen is created, and the three different excretion, detoxification / detox pathways that estrogen, the various estrogens are detoxed, right? So it's kind of good to see it visually, like briefly, in case you want a refresher or whatever. So cholesterol becomes pregnenolone. That's in the mitochondria. That's where it's turned to pregnenolone, which is the precursor to the steroid hormones. From pregnenolone, we can make progesterone, and that has multiple pathways to other things that can be created. And then pregnenolone can also become DHEA through an enzyme, and then it can become androstenedione, and then through another enzyme, it can become estrone. That's E1, that estrogen. But androstenedione can also become testosterone, and then enzymatically, it can become estradiol, which is the most potent estrogen. And then estrone and estradiol can be interconverted between each other. And then the woman in her ovaries creates E2, estradiol. But estrone can be made in the skin, fat cells, and other tissues in the body. So this again really debunks the whole notion of estrogen deficiency issues. Most health issues related to hormonal balance, where estrogen is implicated and so on, seem to be a relative estrogen dominance, right? So that can be a lot of estrogen, or it can be normal amounts of estrogen, physiological amounts, and low progesterone, right? So, and just to give you an example, before I get into the stuff I was going to discuss, if a person, because this can happen to men, and I've seen it on the hormone tests, let's say a person has a lot of fat, they gain a lot of fat, the fat cells have the enzyme that can make estrogen aromatase. That increases the estrogenic potential of the person. So if it's a dude, he might be producing a lot of testosterone, so that side of things might be working well, or he might get on TRT and get testosterone replacement therapy and thinking he's doing good. But because he has that aromatase enzyme in the fat cells, his body may be able to create estrogen very easily because of that. There's an abundance of this enzyme, right? So with women, this, you could be producing progesterone okay, but this is one way you can create a relative estrogen dominance or excess. And then there's other ways, like I mentioned in the previous episode, we have phytoestrogens that are being touted is so amazing for women, and I'll explain why they're not near the end of this episode. Then you have the overall estrogenic environment. So there's a lot of plasticizers and other toxins that are messing with our hormones, and this is why I am constantly going on about the liver flushes and improving detoxification and liver function and reducing toxic exposures and eating clean and not going crazy on the plant foods and stuff like that. So to continue the discussion somewhat, estrogens bind to the estrogen receptor in the cells, okay? And what's interesting is that the estrogen receptor has the ability to bind with a wide variety of compounds with diverse structural features, many environmental toxins and plant compounds can bind to the estrogen receptor with various affinities and modulate estrogen activity. So you can have from the diet a lot of estrogens potentially messing with hormone balance. So this is, in all honesty, one of the biggest reasons why I stopped using most herbs with my clients and myself and my wife. I don't really buy many different herbs. She still uses ashwagandha though, which the KSM 66 extract, it's decent. I was using it for years and we've been using it probably some 4 or 5 years now at this point. I stopped using it, but she still uses that. But we used to use maca and schizandra, so many things, dozens and dozens of things, right? But at one point, this is not too relevant to women, but it's indicative that they are messing with our hormone balance. But I did an experiment. I started, and I apologize if this is too much information, but I started to not track, but attempt to notice if I would get morning wood, as it were, morning erections or erections through the night, and try to see whether herbs made it stop me from having them or added to them, let's say. It's a qualitative experiment, but what I noticed is resveratrol, which is technically an estrogenic, that one, never. If I take it the day before, never. No morning wood. Also, a bunch of other things. Tribulus terrestris, which is supposed to increase testosterone. Maca and a few other things. So I noticed, wait, these things are supposed to increase testosterone or improve hormonal health. This is not indicative that experiment. It was not indicative that they're actually helping. And then subsequently, I found out that there can be differences in a compound, in a plant compound, in how it's extracted. So if it's a water extraction or ethanol or some type other solvent extraction, it can change the characteristics of the plant compound. So the point there is that these things, they have so many phytochemicals in them that it's kind of hit and miss, kind of somewhat random. So you could be, they might isolate one compound in soy, let's say, and that has, in cells, it have a specific effect. In animal, like mice models, it might have quote-unquote beneficial effects, but only for that amount of time, only on those specific markers that they're testing. So we don't know what other collateral potential damage or changes or imbalances are being caused by these things. So that's why I kind of stopped with the herbs. And often I'll tell you, when clients start to work with me, when they're on a lot of supplements already, often I just tell them, can we just pause these things? So I go through all the supplements they're taking. I modulate some of the things they're taking. And then the more complex ones where there's like 20 ingredients or 7 different herbs and whatever, I just say, let's pause these now, see how you feel. And generally, they feel either the same or over the next few weeks, they start feeling better with my protocol. So it's not like we're taking away something and it was keeping them together. Usually the effects are not going to be super noticeable, right? Whereas if you add something that a person is deficient, like let's say vitamin D or B vitamins or vitamin E, well, the effects can be profoundly felt, even though these are minor just basic nutrients, right? So that is why I don't use herbs, because of the there's so many phytoestrogens in them, right? Now, estrogen and cancer, this is a big one. Epidemiological, this is again, I'm just citing bits and pieces from a scientific paper that was on estrogen. No real need to give you the citation or whatever, because this is just common knowledge. You'll find this information everywhere, including on Wikipedia and WebMD. So there's nothing too controversial. I'm the things I'm adding might be a bit more controversial, but when I cite, it's kind of common knowledge. So epidemiological and animal studies have identified estrogen exposure as a risk factor for several cancers, namely breast, endometrium, ovary, prostate, testes, and thyroid. Right? So why would we ever be adding extra estrogens, phytoestrogens, soy flavones, isoflavones, linens, and whatever this other nonsense? Why in the hell would we want to create more of an estrogenic environment? And why in the hell are doctors putting women on estrogenic drugs for birth control and acne and all this other stuff? I just stop there because I'm gonna get angry. I'll just let you put the pieces together yourself, okay? So continuing on from this article, much of the evidence comes from the observation that cancer risk increases with increased exposure to endogenous or exogenous estrogens, and the positive relationship observed between blood levels of estrogens and cancer risk. So endogenous, produced in the body, exogenous, phytoestrogens, and xenoestrogens, plasticizers, toxins, and so on. What else did I want to talk about? So in terms of those metabolites, right? So I told you that there's the three pathways to detoxifying estrogen in the previous episode, the 2OH, 4OH, 16-alpha-OH, and the organic acids, the Dutch test, that dried urine test for comprehensive hormones that we can run on clients, that shows us the pathways and then the preference for which pathways are being dominant. And then there's nutrient cofactors, things like magnesium, certain detoxification enzymes, which gene polymorphisms can affect. We can test for the genes as well if needs be. There's a specific genetic test for estrogen metabolism that we can run. But the 16-OH and the 4-OH are the ones that have, those metabolites are the ones that have been associated with direct genotoxic effects and carcinogenicity, right? The 2-OH pathway, that's the considered the quote-unquote good estrogen. So when we do a Dutch test, we can see if the 4-OH pathway is being preferred. And of course, then we have to figure out what nutritional and lifestyle and genetic factors are at play and start changing variables to improve that. Not hard. We just have to know what really, that's the whole point of lab testing, is we have to know what areas of the metabolism need the most attention immediately. Because certain things you can let them be for a while as you improve more higher priority things, right? So some researchers believe increased levels of 16-AOH, that's the one of the pathway in the middle in terms of badness, I suppose, may increase the risk of breast cancer by increasing both cell proliferation. So the estrogens and their metabolites, they stimulate cell proliferation. And if that cell is damaged, or they can also damage it apparently, that is obviously problematic proliferation. We want the healthy cells to proliferate, right? And then so it can also directly damage the DNA. Some of these metabolites can damage DNA. And apparently the 2OH metabolite, which is the least bad or the good estrogen, it's called, that one can induce cell death, programmed cell death, which is appropriate if a cell is dysfunctional, but functional enough to know it's dysfunctional. It will trigger its own suicide, quote-unquote, or apoptosis, which can inhibit its, you know, self-proliferation, and that is how the body prevents the spread of cancers or the proliferation of cancers. Now, risk. Next topic, risk factors for increased estrogen exposure. So, as I mentioned in the previous episode, excess fat gain increases endogenous estrogen production by fat tissue. So the enzyme aromatase will convert the adrenal hormones, so DHEA, androstenedione, into estrogen. Also, excess insulin in the bloodstream prompts the ovaries to secrete excess testosterone and reduce sex hormone binding globulins, globulin, thus increasing levels of free estrogen. So that's an interesting thing. A lot of people now have insulin resistance, which is something that, you know, I discuss this in my book in more depth, so I can't really belabor the point here. But insulin resistance is not just people eating too many carbs for too long and then the cells become resistant to insulin. You could have a lot of free fatty acids in the blood, a lot of circulating fat, which is triggered, can be triggered by stress or being overweight, and that can actually inhibit the uptake of glucose into the cells, and this is a mechanism to insulin resistance, and that can actually cause issues metabolically speaking, right? So, but it's a factor. It can cause issues, right? Another thing, alcohol consumption increases estrogen levels. Epidemiological studies suggest that moderate alcohol consumption increases the risk of, well, they say increases the risk of breast cancer, but what they should be saying is associated with a higher incidence of breast cancer, right? Because epidemiological studies cannot show causality. They can only show association. But it's at least they're stating it here, right? Because we've been told that, oh, you know, a couple of glasses of wine a day is good for you. Come on. It's a fucking toxin. Alcohol is a toxin. I used to drink a lot. So I'm not judging people that drink. I used to drink a lot. And I mentioned my story in my book. I had a very suboptimal lifestyle. So I did a lot of things terribly. But I never for a second thought, oh, but it's good for heart health, or it's going to, you know, at least I'm getting my 2 glasses of wine a day, and that's good for me. I always knew I was poisoning myself. And my problem stemmed from childhood trauma and stress. I won't be telling you my whole life story here. This is more about educating yourself about how to protect yourself, right? So I learned a lot of stuff in my health journey to fix my own health stuff that I was destroying. I learned a lot along the way, and helping my wife with her health issues that her 20 years of ballet training and career and so on caused a lot of health problems, and doctors caused further health problems. With all their antibiotics and birth controls and stuff like that. So along the way, I learned a bunch of stuff, and then working with clients, obviously, super. That's like 10x. You learn 10x, 100x when you actually work with clients. So I'm just trying to spread the message so more women can learn how to protect themselves. So let's not. Again, I'm not judging or anything, but let's not. Let's not delude ourselves that alcohol is in any way beneficial, right? In any way. Even as a hormetic stressor, I know some people know what that means. If you don't, it doesn't matter so much. But as a, if you want to use alcohol as a hormetic stressor, the amount of alcohol is 2 tablespoons. That is enough of a tiny stress that will cause the body to adapt and upregulate its detoxification enzymes and stuff like that, which is what hormesis is. What doesn't kill me only makes me stronger. But the amount required is like a couple of tablespoons, not a couple of glasses. So, but all that is to say, so estrogen has been, so alcohol consumption increases estrogen levels. Is all I should have said. I went on like a freaking telling you my life story here. Apologize. So point there is alcohol consumption increases estrogen levels. And epidemiological studies suggest that moderate alcohol consumption is associated with a higher incidence of breast cancer. Two major sources of exogenous estrogens are oral contraceptives and hormone replacement therapy. And this is where I have to just state the what I want to say quickly and move on, because I'm going to get angry. It makes me angry. So putting women on hormone replacement therapy that includes estrogen and synthetic progestogens, which are also very harmful, or oral contraceptives, this is a crime against humanity. And the doctors that are complicit in this, ignorant of the fact, sure, they are, most of them, but they are complicit in the pharma mafia scam. Okay? And I've seen what these commonly used drugs are doing to women, the SSRIs, the oral contraceptives, the pill, etc. They are destroying the health of millions and millions of women. This is an absolute travesty, crime against humanity. That's all I'll say, right? And we have to just learn the fact, because a lot of people still have trust in this corrupt, disgusting system. Anyway, another major source of estrogens is environmental toxins that are structurally similar to estrogen and have the ability to mimic harmful estrogens in the body. These include aromatic hydrocarbons, which, by the way, these are aromatic hydrocarbons. These can also form from the combustion of stuff, so fuel for cars and trucks and whatever, barbecues and just anything that burns. It creates a lot of different compounds. Some of them are well known as polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and these are, some of them apparently have estrogenic activity. Then also organochlorine pesticides, which are found in pesticides, like I said, herbicides, but also in plastics and refrigerants and industrial solvents that a lot of us are getting exposed to on a daily basis. So this goes back to, why am I so big on, and my program with my clients includes so much emphasis on detoxing, reducing toxic exposures, eating clean organic food, eating less plants, more animal products, and making sure those animal products weren't grown or produced with the use of hormones and crap. And, less plants means less phytoestrogens, right? So those are the things we need to be doing, as not as nice to have anymore. If you want to live a long time and be healthy and not develop debilitating health issues, you really have to make detoxing, reducing toxic exposures, doing liver flushes at least a couple of times a year after you've done a bunch of them, eating clean organic food, reducing the stuff you buy that is potentially, toxic plastics and stuff like that. Sometimes it can mean moving out of the big city, because that's a massive source of air pollution. It's a huge source of toxic exposure. And I hate to be the I don't want to be the doom and gloom guy, but sometimes you just have to. I know not everybody can, but if you can, if you have the means, and you know, you got to think about it at least, right? So here's the thing, right? So here's the thing. These phytoestrogens, I just want to talk a little bit a bit more about the phytoestrogens. That I don't know, it's all marketing, right? It's all marketing designed to sell you, not snake oil, but shit that is bad for you. So you have the isoflavones. So in soy, you have genistein, excuse me, diazine. And then there's other things like equiol, purarin, comesetrol, glycitane, biochannins, and these are these are found in soy, in beans, peas, clover, alfalfa, and kudzu. I don't know what kudzu is, but beans. If I never eat beans again in my life, I will have lost nothing. Or soy. Or peas, clover and alfalfa. Are we sheep? Who the hell is eating clover and alfalfa? Please do yourself a favor. Like, don't eat this crap. Once in a while, if you want to eat like a tofu salad at a someone cooked up, or you're at a restaurant and that's all they have, and or you know, if my wife makes burritos, or let's say we're doing burritos and my wife wants beans as a side dish, I might throw a little bit on my burritos. It's not the end of the world. But would I consider beans a staple in my diet? For what? For the carbs, for the protein, for the fiber? No. This is super low quality protein, very low bioavailability, and so is soy, so is peas. All of these grains, seeds, nuts, that protein, that number that you see is just a number. The actual bioavailability could be as little as half, like with beans, for example. I think it's like 54% or something. Whereas with milk and meat, we're in the 85, 90-plus percent, right? So these isoflavones, this stuff, and a lot of this research is done in test tubes and stuff, like in vitro. So they might see a mechanism, but that mechanism might not actually translate to positive outcomes in a human. And then they might do like mice studies with them, and then certain markers might move the way they want, and then that study gets published, and then that can be marketed as, oh, isoflavones do this and this and that, have this and that effect. But what are they doing? What are they doing? Let's say I'll just explain. So you have the phytoestrogen, so they have activity, they can bind to the estrogen receptor, right? So what that can do is that can, I think it's called, what's the word, inhibition, or so they compete for estrogen, so they will bind to the receptor, activate the receptor. What can happen is that could be a weaker, let's say phytoestrogen has a weaker activity than the E2 estradiol. So that may be beneficial because it's a less potent estrogen. And what it could also do is the body could downregulate production of estrogen, because the estrogen receptor is activated. So it's like when you inject testosterone in a dude, his testicles shrink, his body stops producing testosterone because there's enough around, so it downregulates production. So you could theoretically, with these phytoestrogens, you could downregulate your own production of estrogen, which may make you feel better if those phytoestrogens are less potent estrogens. But for how long? What other effects are they having? You know, what happens when you stop that phytoestrogen? Maybe the body will create a sudden increase in estrogen, and that could cause you a bunch of different horrible symptoms. So there's so much collateral effects that we're not taking into account with these phytoestrogens. There's so much better ways to do it. So manifestations of excessive estrogen exposure and estrogen dominance. So an abundance of evidence makes it clear that excessive estrogen exposure from endogenous and exogenous sources is a causal factor in the development of cancer in hormone-dependent tissues such as the breast, endometrium, ovary, uterus, and prostate. Furthermore, hormonal imbalances between progesterone, testosterone, and estrogen can lead to symptoms and conditions of estrogen dominance. These include premenstrual syndrome, endometriosis, uterine fibroid tumors, fibrocystic or painful breasts, cervical dysplasia, and systemic lupus erythematosus. Erythematosus. That's a hard word to say. Erythematosus. So this is why it's important to know this stuff and not fall victim potentially to the marketing of the phytoestrogens, that they're good for you, that various chemicals that you may be offered are ever a good idea. Okay, so hopefully, you know what, if one person benefits from this information, I'm still happy, you know. And then, so I explained the whole piece with the phytoestrogens. I just want to discuss a couple of other things that are, again, important. I know I kind of will sound like a broken record about some of these things, but some people can actually benefit from fiber in this instance if they don't have too much of an overgrowth of bad bacteria that the fiber will feed. Having fiber in the diet can actually bind some of these estrogens. So if they, in some cases, if the bacteria that secrete that beta glucuronidase that unbinds the estrogen from the glucuronic acid, some of these fibers can bind that potentially. But the problem is that dietary fiber intake also increases serum concentrations of sex hormone binding globulin. So that can bind some of the free estradiol, and you that's a benefit for a while. But what that increasing sex hormone binding globulin can also bind testosterone, and that can cause issues because testosterone is in many ways opposes estrogen and cortisol and these stress hormones. So this is again another very sort of allopathic or symptom quick fix type thing. It doesn't actually address the root of the issue, right? So I'm not you probably, if you've been listening to me for any length of time, you know I'm not a big fan of too many plant foods in the diet, and I don't think fiber is all that they're touting it to be, right? So I would prefer doing other things than increasing fiber intake for anything, any issue, really any issue, including constipation. And there's a whole chapter in my book. It's not very long, but it's enough for you to learn a bunch of stuff about gut health. It's called Give Your Gut Some Love. I explain a few things around fiber there, but it's other actual things that I think women need to address is protein. So you need to ideally eat 100 grams of animal, high quality animal protein per day, because the amino acids in the protein, they are required to make those detoxification enzymes that are required to detoxify estrogen, estradiol, and so on, right? Yeah, so I already talked about the isoflavones in soy and legumes and alfalfa. Like I said, they're unpredictable. you know, they have unknown effects that we don't know and we may never know. So I would always, that's why I prefer to use amino acids and multi vitamins, fat soluble B vitamins, minerals as well. These are kind of my favorite things to tweak the biology to shift it in the right balance. That can include hormonal balance. These plant foods are just so many unknowns that why would we want to add additional estrogenic burden to the body, right? With the hope that it would downregulate its own production, because the estrogen receptors are being activated by soy isoflavones. I think it's a little bit risky. A lot of the research is just based on like I said, in vitro studies and animal research. And I wanted to briefly touch on, there's a couple of compounds you may have heard of, indole-3-carbinol and DIM, which is diindolemethane. And I believe both of them, I know indole-3-carbinol is a naturally occurring compound from cruciferous vegetables such as broccoli, Brussels sprouts, and cabbage. And apparently that actively promotes the breakdown of estrogen to the beneficial, quote-unquote, beneficial metabolite, 2-OH. And then the researchers in this paper, they are like, however, modern diets are often deficient in these vegetables. It's like, can you be deficient in anything that is found in a vegetable? Maybe vitamin C, if it's found in there, but fruit is a better source. You know, there's some minerals. If you cook them well, you can release them. But this is crazy. So these DIM and indole-3-carbinol and curcumin and stuff like that, these things may stimulate or cruciferous vegetables, they stimulate the upregulation of detoxification enzymes in the liver. But I already told you, those enzymes are made from amino acids and protein, which is something you can be deficient in. And to detoxify estrogen, like I mentioned in the previous episode, you need B vitamins, which you can be deficient in. And the best sources of those things are animal protein and eggs, liver, meat, and milk has B vitamins as well. So again, these mainstream strategies of muscling down estrogen with what are actually, in effect, these are toxins. They're extracting toxins, and the toxin, it's just that the toxin from these plants has an effect that modulates some markers on lab tests that in a way that is considered beneficial. So you can in the case of indole-3-carbinol or DIM can lower estrogens. Indole-3-carbinol can increase the 2-OH metabolite, and that can decrease the 4-OH and the 16-AOH metabolites. But that's three markers here. What other things is it doing at the end of the day? We don't know, because they're happy with that result. That's enough to get you published, your paper published, right? So, and this is from this paper that I'm citing, they also state, I won't read the whole paragraph, but they say I3C, indole-3-carbinol, promotes an increased ratio of 2-OH to 16-AOH and may improve estrogen metabolism in women with poor diets or impaired detoxification. So a lot of these, again, mainstream or allopathic strategies, if you want to call it, they're just tactics. They're like, okay, if your diet is bad, and to them, a diet is bad if you don't eat enough vegetables, like cruciferous vegetables, or impaired detoxification. If you have those issues, this indole-3-carbinol can help you, or DIM can help you. But, okay, that can help move some markers now for a few months while you're taking the supplement, and then they can deem you as a lesser risk for whatever issue potentially. But what's going to happen in a few months when you stop taking the compound, right? Or when the compound stops working because the body gets better at excreting it, right? So instead of doing that, why don't we figure out what is impairing detoxification? Is it gallstones? Probably is in the liver. Is it cholestasis or sluggish bile flow? Probably most people have this issue today because there's so many toxins that are getting recirculated in the bile that is just causing problems in the liver and so on. There are people not eating enough protein, not eating enough of the right types of protein, like collagenous tissues that have the glycine, which is super important for these detoxification enzymes, right? So I think what some of these plant compounds are, in fairness, just to kind of be, try to be a bit balanced, some of these plant compounds can actually have beneficial properties. So certain things can inhibit that enzyme that creates estrogen aromatase. So that can be truly a beneficial effect. The problem is a lot of them are temporary effects. So again, it's not a solution. It's a band-aid. Some of these plant compounds can be estrogen receptor antagonists, right? So they can, that's what the term I was thinking of earlier was competitive inhibition. So for example, indole-3-carbinol can prevent stronger estrogens from binding at the or binding to the estrogen receptor. So, but that goes back to what I said. Do we want to do that, or do we want to reduce the estrogenic burden, help the body excrete the, you know, detoxify and excrete the estrogen, stimulate the production or supplement with the protective hormones as well, right? So progesterone, pregnenolone can help. Some people, DHEA can help, but you have to take tiny amounts because, especially with women, it can easily be converted to estrogen, right? So we can do these things, and these are compounds that the body recognizes, right? So I personally think it's a much better strategy to take an amino acid or pregnenolone or vitamins or whatever that the body recognizes and can readily utilize, than kind of spray and pray with literally hundreds of compounds in each herb, hundreds of them, and then hope some of those are going to have a beneficial effect that will outweigh the negative effect. But I think with plants, there's, because there's so many phytoestrogens and there's so many toxins in plants, right, that it's an ill-advised, misguided approach. And I'm hoping you're starting to see why. And so what to actually do is, like I already mentioned, I would rather supplement with the progesterone, pregnenolone, and amino acids, and get the liver working. But there is other things. So vitamin E, so low serum vitamin E is associated with elevated estrogen levels. And women with PMS experienced symptomatic improvements when supplemented alpha-tocopherol. Now keep in mind, alpha-tocopherol that they're talking about is in the study. I don't know, I'm not going to check the reference, but I'm 99% sure that it was a synthetic alpha-tocopherol, because most studies use synthetic stuff. So if synthetic suboptimal alpha-tocopherol supplementation helped, we have to really extrapolate that using a full spectrum, naturally sourced and extracted vitamin E, pure and clean product is going to have good effects. Vitamin E inhibits in vivo and in vitro growth of breast cancer cells, apparently, possibly by inhibiting the expression of vascular endothelial growth factor, which encourages angiogenesis. Not that important here. Then magnesium. So magnesium is an essential factor of the COMT enzyme. I think I spoke about that in the previous episode, and therefore optimizes the methylation and excretion of the catecholestrogen. So this is a methylation is the pathway to one of the pathways to excrete estrogen. So that enzyme requires magnesium. So having enough magnesium, when I say enough, I don't think for most people 200-300 milligrams is enough. If a person has health issues, I would say they need more than 400 milligrams per day of high quality magnesium. And then magnesium has other benefits. And then the B vitamins, I already spoke about those. So those are required for the transformation of estrogen into compounds that we can excrete into the bile, right? So you need B6. That's a big one. I think estrogen can deplete B6, maybe because it's increasing the burden on the body to excrete it. So a lot of B6 is being used. And also B12 and folate. These are important cofactors for the enzymes involved in estrogen conjugation and methylation, right? So, and the researchers state, therefore, decreased levels of B vitamins can disrupt estrogen detoxification and lead to increased levels of circulating estrogens. So, folate is an essential factor for methylation of cal. So, excuse me. So, yeah, these are important. And that's why when we supplement B vitamins, I always recommend products with the methylated forms of B12, methylcobalamin, and methylfolate, not folic acid. Generally, if you see a supplement with folic acid and cyanocobalamin, it's crap. It's not worth the money. I will not use it. So yeah, that is about it. I think I'll stop there. It's a lot of information. So I'll let you digest it. My plan is for the next episode to discuss premenstrual syndrome, PMS. That's how I started. I wanted to do an episode on PMS and the role of estrogen there. But as you can see, there's a few things you gotta kind of understand, at least at a basic level, for that discussion to make sense. So I thought, let me do this first. And then that will sort of give you background and set the stage for the next one, which is PMS, which is now we can start thinking, how can we apply our knowledge of, usually the issue is too much estrogen in some way, whether that's a relative progesterone lack or too much estrogen. It's usually estrogen dominance rearing its ugly head. And then, of course, there's other issues. With it, always it's never one thing, you know. It's generally cortisol is a factor that increases stress, and then it will increase adrenaline. So there's always a number of different things. But I think understanding estrogen for women is important for the reasons I explained. One of the biggest ones being to know that anyone offering you various chemicals and so on is not going to be very helpful. Anyway, if you need help with your health stuff, book a free intro call on my website, and would love to talk to you. And thank you for watching or listening, and I'll see you on the next one.